Okay. We were, well, first of all, before I go back to lecturing, questions of course on course mechanics and anything like that. Okay. Yeah, if we could lower those. I sometimes think I'm the last person who can manipulate Venetian blinds because I grew up with them, as everybody did in my childhood. But I'm not sure people know now how to deal with Venetian blinds. Okay. And if it's too bright and you prefer that, I can darken the room further, but then you can't so much see your hand. Well, that's, maybe that's okay. What's the problem?
I think it flipped. It turned on the lights at front.
On the lights? I don't know. Oh, you mean between the three, the previous setting and this one, somehow more lights came on at the front?
Yeah, the ones right at front turned on instead. I think something.
If I go to three.
That's working.
Oh. But then these are. Okay, I tell you what. That's off, all of them, and now you're all going to go to sleep. But I think. Okay. The other thing I can do is lower the Meccano shades at the front. Let's see if they, sometimes they come down, they tangle with chairs and things, but maybe this will. I think this is helping, actually. Okay, maybe I can go back to here. Is that a little bit more visible at front than before? I see both kinds of shaking of heads. Okay, we'll go back to off. But now you're really in the dark. Okay. There's not a dimmer switch for these things. Okay, just to reprise a little bit, I was talking about outgroup routing, which is basically the idea that you, the criterion, in this case parsimony, but the same will be true of some distance matrix methods and most, a lot of likelihood and Bayesian methods. They infer an unrooted tree. They don't really tell you where the root is. If the model of change in the characters has certain statistical properties, reversibility, or in the case of parsimony, if it penalizes equal and backward, then you end up with an unrooted tree. Then the question is, well, where is the root? And you can think of it as knowing the answer in advance if you have an in-group, which is just the name for the group, usually the group you're really interested in this case primates. Then you have an out group mouse. It's called an out group because it's on the other side of the root. So you have a prior knowledge that the root is here. And you can think of it just as using that prior knowledge, or you can think of it as, well, we have the in group. And we're going to have to find out where the root is, so let's find an out group that we know is on the other side of the root, throw it into the analysis, and then it becomes something substantive that you're doing. By putting the out group in and seeing where it attaches, you are locating the root of the in group. Okay, so I just wanted to repeat that because it may have gone by a little too quickly. And I wanted to just end up, the material is really the material from yesterday, that saying another thing you can do is get lengths for these branches. Now you have to be a little careful as to what you want them to mean. For parsimony, the simplest way is to take all of the reconstructions of the most parsimonious reconstructions of states on this particular tree, and basically, for each branch, averaging over those different reconstructions, count how many changes there are in each branch. If you do that for this particular case, you'll find that you get. Well, this thing is maybe it's not the battery. Okay. You get half a change to alpha on the branch to alpha, 1.5 here. 1, 1.5, 2.5, 1, and 1. If you add those up, they do add to 8. Because what we did is we averaged reconstructions, each of which added up to 8. So these averages do correctly. Now you might say, oh, okay, that gives you an idea which branches are in some sense longer. But then you have to say, well, in what sense? Is it time we're looking at, or is it a rate of change? And what about all the non-parsimonious possibilities? What about all the possible ways you could get the data with 9 changes or 10 changes? Are those meaningless? Are those contributing nothing? And the answer really is, no, actually they're relevant, but in a parsimony method, you concentrate only on the most parsimonious ones. And I should also make the point that what we've been doing is taking, we first started taking a given tree and finding out the minimum possible number of changes on it. And that's been called the small parsimony problem because it turns out it's very solvable, as we'll see in a moment. But it also doesn't solve the problem of searching among trees to get that number as small as possible. That is the large parsimony problem. What we're going to do today is to go to that problem and tell you about an algorithm by Walter Fitch. So we're still in the small parsimony problem. We're asking what's the count, the minimum number of possible changes for a given tree that somebody has given us. And we haven't yet tackled the issue of how you search tree space. We're going to be coming to that. Walter Fitch was a major figure in molecular evolution. He died in 2011. He trained as a comparative biochemist. And in the 1960s, I've heard a somewhat unverified rumor that one of the things he did in the early 60s was using all kinds of indirect evidence at the point when people were trying to work out the genetic code. They're just beginning to do experiments that would give insight as to which codons gave which amino acids. And everybody knew that there was a code table out there, but nobody knew what it was. Walter apparently published a paper in the early 60s making a guess at the genetic code. Now, he was wrong. And that's very fortunate, because then that led him, because if he had been right, that would have been the end of his career. Everybody would say, he's the guy who got the genetic code, isn't it wonderful? He would never have had time to do the subsequent work. But fortunately, he was wrong. And in the 1960s, he did important work pioneering distance matrix methods in papers with Emmanuel Margoliash on cytochromes. And in 1971, he was by then working on phylogenies. He was at the University of Wisconsin then, and later moved to University of California, Irvine. And he came up with a very cute algorithm for counting the number of state changes on that would be most parsimonious on a given tree. In other words, for solving the small parsimony problem. There was some earlier work by other people with simpler 0-1 cases that also addressed this issue. This algorithm, the Fitch algorithm, though, has become the sort of standard way to do it. And I'm going to show it to you for the case of DNA sequences where there are 4 states and where we can change symmetrically between any state and any other state. Now, the same algorithm will work fine if you just have 2 states, like 0, 1. So what this algorithm is, I'll give you the sort of formal description of it here, which looks maybe a little bit difficult, but then I'll show it to you working. You'll see it's very simple. You go up to the tips of the tree, and at each tip you make a set with those nucleotides that are possible at that tip, which means you know it's an A there, the set just contains the letter A. But if you knew, if there was an ambiguity, if somebody said, well, that one we only know that it's a purine, it's either A or G, then you make a set that contains both A and G. It's the set of possible nucleotides at each tick. And this will be to count the steps at a single site, a single column of the alignment, a single column of the data table. Okay. You make a set at each tip that has the possible nucleotides there. If there's a total ambiguity, if we just didn't sequence that site, then you make a set with all four possibilities in it. Okay. Now, you go down the tree. There are various orders in which you could do that, but the important thing is you can consider a node only after you've considered its two immediate descendants. And what you do is you construct the intersection of the two sets in the two immediate descendants. This still isn't working. I'll just point. So you take the intersection of the two sets. Now, if the set is empty, you do two things. You say, okay, that set is empty. Instead, let's take the union of the two sets. The second thing you do is you count one step. You have a counter and you bump the counter, you push it forward, it counts a step. Now you have a set, which is either this intersection or it's this union, depending if the intersection was empty. Now you continue on down the tree, and that's all there is to the algorithm. So let's see it in operation. Here is a tree, five tips. The sets are CACAG. So you've observed the nucleotides at those points. I'm going to try to put yet one more pair of batteries in this thing.
I'm using rechargeable, so the fact that I keep using up my batteries may be not such a terrible thing. Let's get this. See if this can be revived. What the problem is, this thing is kept in my pouch, and I think sometimes it sits in the pouch and something. Whoops! There we go. That was brilliant.
Sometimes I think the pouch presses on the on button, the thing stays on in the pouch. Now let's see if it works. No, it's not. Okay. That's that. We take the old-fashioned method here. Okay. So, and I like that at this point when I start using an old-fashioned stick as a pointer, remember the molecular evolution workshop that I went to in Canada in the 90s, which was at was held in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, which is an important old cod fishing port. And the organization that was running this conference had rented the Fisheries Museum in Lunenburg. And the Fisheries Museum gave you a screen, and for your pointer, they gave you a seal harpoon. So it had a big wicked point on it, and you had to be real careful not to run it through the projection. So this is a little less dangerous. Okay. So here are the sets. Now we're going to go down the tree. Let's find a place on the tree where both descendants are already determined. Well, that would be either here or here. Let's try this one. Well, what do? You take the intersection of these two sets. Now, that's empty. So instead, you're going to make the union of the two sets. And there it is. And the union is A and C. And I'm putting an asterisk on it to indicate we've also advance the pointer one for that. Now we go to another place on the tree where both descendants are determined, are already there. Here again, the intersection will be zero, and so you put the union and advance the pointer. Continuing, for that one, you take A, G, and C. Those don't overlap, so when you take their intersection, you get nothing. You take instead their union and advance the pointer a third time. And now you go to the bottom of the tree. It's the only one left. Taking the intersection of these two sets, you find that A and C are in both of them, so the intersection is non-empty.
and you don't advance the pointer. Result, three steps. It's going to take three steps to evolve these tips on this tree. And this is a correct, I can give you a rationale for why it works, but what I'm really going to do is go on to a more generalized algorithm in a moment and give you the, you know, show you the rationale for that. Please, yes.
What do you mean advance the pointer?
Well, you have advance the counter.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, the counter. You got a little counter going.
And then you don't at the end.
I kept saying pointer instead of counter.
And at the base of the tree.
At the base of the tree, the intersection is non-empty, so you don't add a count. So you've made three, you've had three of these events in which the intersection was empty. And each time, you counted one step. Okay? So this is something that can be done by computer. You write a little algorithm to do it, not very hard. It's also pretty fast. If you had a tree with like 100 tips, there'd be 99 interior nodes there, and all you'd have to do is 99 of these operations for that site, and you would correctly count the number of tips. Now you might look at this and say, oh, I see what those sets are. Those sets are the reconstructed ancestors. That's almost true, but it's not. Because if you look, you will see, let's look at G, the G up here. It gets into this node and into that node, but actually, in any most parsimonious reconstruction, G is not there in those nodes. The only time you need a G is at the last minute on this branch, and no parsimonious reconstruction of ancestral states will actually have a G there. So, no, those are not quite the ancestral states. I think they include them all, but there's, if you really wanted to infer the ancestral states here, you'd have to go back and prune out some stuff. But what this gets you is the count. So very quickly, for any site, you can get the count of the number of changes in any most parsimonious reconstruction. In this case, it's three. Okay. So that's the Fitch algorithm. And then what we're going to do is go on to a slightly more sophisticated algorithm called the Sankoff algorithm. I should say that all of these algorithms are really one or another example of a class of algorithms for finding the shortest path through a graph. So what I'm going to show you here is, if I have this graph, now the graphs we're working at are related to the trees, I'll show you in a moment how they relate. But suppose I just have a graph, and every branch here has a cost of going along that branch. The cost might be, for example, driving time to get from one town to another. And you want to go from this city up here to that city down there in the shortest amount of driving time. Well, one thing you could do is say, well, let's consider all possible paths. We'll count them all up. We'll pick the ones that are smallest. That would involve all kinds of crazy paths, like going on here and back up there and over here and up there and down there and over here and back up here. I mean, just, and when you start counting them up, there's a very large number of them. So you're going to have to struggle a lot to make sure you look at all of them, and then it's going to take you a long time. But there's an easier way. And the easier way is to say, we want to find, let's for the moment say, actually, we're going to find the driving time, and then later is the issue of, well, what route actually achieves that driving time. In order to do it, what we can say is, well, we don't know the best driving time from here to here. Let us work out the best driving time to here, the best driving time to there, and the best driving time to there, the nearest nodes. And there they are. It turns out that you can go with 6 minutes, in 6 minutes here, you can go in 4 minutes there, and to get to this one, going directly, it takes 8 minutes, but if you go through this down, it takes only 7.
Okay. Well, let's imagine, I'm not going to give you details of the algorithm exactly, but say, suppose we'd worked that out. Suppose we had worked out that it takes you 7 to get to here, 4 to get to there, and 6 to get to there. We can then go down the graph, and we can say, what's the best time to get to here, to here, to here, and to there? And if you do that, you can start to fill in the best driving times to, it takes, for example, to go to here, well, we know it takes 7 minutes to here and 4 minutes to there, and this takes 5 minutes and that takes 8 minutes. Those are both 12. The best driving time to that one is 12. You can go over here and work on that one. 4 plus 7 or 6 plus 3, which is smaller, well, 6 plus 3 is. So that's the best driving time to there. And you can continue down the graph working out best driving times. And when you do that, when you get to the bottom, you have achieved, you found that the best driving time to here is 21 minutes. Now you might say, okay, if we can work out that out stage by stage, working through the graph without necessarily keeping track of exactly which route achieved it, we end up with the right answer. And if we want to find the actual route, you have to backtrack through the graph. And if you do that, what you can do is say, well, we'll start with 21 here. We know it takes 21 minutes, which is the where did we come from to get those 21 minutes? Well, this would be 18 plus 7 is 25, so it's not that. This would be 20 plus 6, that's 26, it's not that. But it could be either 19 plus 2 or 17 plus 4. Similarly, you can work out that from here, which takes, you take 14 minutes to get here, but 14 plus 5 is 19, 14 plus 3 is 17, so those are two routes to get from here to there. And you can work your way back up. I'm not describing things very exactly here. You can work your way back up the graph and then find that, in fact, here is a summary of the best routes. The best route always starts out with these three steps, and then it could go either this way or that way. And this strategy of working out solving partial solutions progressively through the graph is referred to as dynamic programming, which is a very fancy and powerful sounding name. And in fact, it's the method that you use if you have a navigation device or you're using your cell phone to navigate and you go to Google Maps or you go to any one of the other mapping systems and you say, what's the best way to drive, you know, from here to Yakima? And it says, okay, I'm calculating and here's the route. It's using a descendant of this dynamic programming method. Of course, all sorts of extra trickery and partial solutions pre-stored and all kinds of things to speed it up are in there. It won't even look at some very long distance possibilities because you can kind of rule them out and it has all sorts of trickery for that. This simple algorithm, however, is what is at the basis of finding you the best route in any kind of mapping device. Well, these minimum steps algorithms are really similar. They're really solving essentially that problem. Here is a simple graph showing that. Here is a species up here. There's a tree, an evolutionary tree, phylogeny, that is a lineage that splits in two and goes to these two species. We could think of the possible nucleotides at a certain site in this species and make them as dots, make dots here. And then we could connect up, we could think of the possible nucleotides in the median ancestor and in the more distant ancestor down here. And then we could draw lines between them. And if you go along, this will, for example, be A, the letter A. If I go up to the letter A here, I haven't made any change of nucleotide. So along that green line, there is a driving time of 0. There's a penalty of 0. But if I go up one of the other green lines, I have a penalty of 1 because I've changed the nucleotide. And we can put penalties on all of these lines. And then we can say, well, look, we happen to know that this is a C up here. In that case, you erase those nodes and you just have the lines coming into the C. Over here, we might say, well, we know that's a G. So you keep G and you throw away the others. You trim off the part, the irrelevant parts of the graph. You can imagine yourself down here. You could start at any of these bases, and then solving the shortest path through this will, in fact, give you the count that we'll get out of the Fitch algorithm. Or, if you made the penalty 0 and 1 for no change and a change, it would be the Fitch algorithm. And I'm also going to show you another algorithm in a second. So there really is a relationship between the shortest path through the graph, dynamic programming solutions of the shortest path through a graph, and these algorithms for counting, for solving the small parsimony problem, giving you the count. Okay, let me show you the more elaborate algorithm. It's invented by David Sankoff, who was he's currently at the University of Ottawa. When he did all this, he was at the University of Montreal. And this is a shot of him about 20, 25 years ago, which puzzled me because he's an applied mathematician, so you see him writing math, but he seems to be writing it in midair. And then so I looked at it and said, well, he's obviously writing it on a pane of glass, but what's the puzzle that I was so confused by?
Is he writing backwards?
Because he's on the other side of the pane of glass, and if he's writing this math, which is forwards, he's actually sitting there and able to somehow write math backwards. So I had two theories. I said, one theory was that he wrote the math forward and then went around behind the glass and pretended to write. Okay.
Seems like the most parsimony.
That's a fairly parsimony. But the other possibility is that he stood in back of the glass and wrote the math forwards, and then the photographers flipped the image. Well, there was a way I thought of checking that, because I said, look, if he parts his hair on one side, we could detect that he's got his hair parted on the wrong side. So I looked at various pictures of David, and unfortunately, he's too symmetrical. Right-handed. It's more likely that he hasn't been flipped because he's writing with his right hand, but I don't know if he's left-handed. So at an evolution meeting in Ottawa in 2011, I ran into David and I just asked him. And he said this shot was taken for a newsletter of some organization that was funding him. He said it was done in his house and they brought their own black glass blackboard with them. And he said he wrote on it and then went around behind it. So the picture hasn't been flipped. Okay. Anyway, David's an applied mathematician. And in 1974, he came up with a very general algorithm, which he then applied to a much harder problem than the simple parsimony problems. But let me outline to you the Sankoff algorithm. Let us see. Now, I'll give it to you in the abstract form, but then we'll show it to you working on an example. What you do is you define a quantity that you're going to have at each node of the tree. And I'll call it S sub ki, and that looks terribly complex. The k is which node you're at. First of all, we're considering only one site in the alignment of DNA. And we have, if there were DNA, there would be 4 of these quantities at point L on the tree. The subscript will be which point of the tree you're on. The argument here will be which of the 4 nucleotides you're considering. And what it's going to, it will have an interpretation. It's the quantity that you'll put up here. There'll be an S for A, and 1 for C, and 1 for G, and 1 for T. There'll be 4 of them, 4 numbers. And each number is the number of steps that you require from node K on upwards in the tree, at node K or above, given, this is important, given conditional on node K being in that particular state. So it's going to say, if I'm in state A here, how many changes are needed from there on up on the tree? If I'm in state C, how many changes from there on up? In state G, how many changes are there on up, and so on. So we're going to, at each node in the tree, have four numbers, each one for one of the possible states, saying what the count is from there on up, if that state is there. Okay. And there they are, at point L in the tree. We're going to have a number for S sub L of A, S sub L of C, S sub L of G, S sub L of T. We'll have similar numbers at point R, the right node. And we're going to come up with a method for determining what those four numbers should be in the immediate ancestor. Okay. And this is really just simple bookkeeping logic. No subtle mathematics involved at all. First of all, we're also going to say, if a certain state is impossible there, for example, at a tip, if we didn't observe it, if we look at a tip and find a T, then states A, G, and C are impossible, and we're going to handle that by saying the numbers for that will be infinity. So up at the tips, you just put infinities for all the states you didn't observe, and zero for all the states that you could have there. And that also, by the way, can take care of ambiguities, because if it's known only to be a purine, you want to put zeros for the two purines and infinity for the two pyrimidines. If you didn't sequence that state, that site at that point on the tree, you want to put zeros for all four possibilities, because they're all possible. Okay. And now here's the algorithm, and it may look intimidating, but it is just simple bookkeeping. It's going to say, well, if I have, let's say I have, I'm computing this thing, S in this immediate ancestor state, given that there's a C there, and we are assuming we have computed these quantities for the two immediate descendants. Again, it's going to be a working your way down the tree algorithm. And we're going to set up the zeros and infinities up at the tips, the zeros being for any state that's possible, and then work out the interior node, these arrays at the interior nodes one at a time. So we're assuming we know these L ones for the L node, and we know these ones for the R node. What's the formula for getting these? Well, let's take this one. If you think you have a C here, what's the smallest number of steps you could have from there on up in the tree? Now, I'm also going to assume that the number of the penalty you get, the number of steps you count, for going, say, from C to G might be different than from going from C to A. So we're going to consider here not just the case Walter Fitch considered, where you get a penalty of one for any change in state. We're going to allow an arbitrary table of penalties for going from one particular state to another. So this is a more general algorithm. And we're going to assume that table is this thing Cij. It's the cost of going from I to J. And we have a table sitting somewhere. So we've got that table, and we've got these quantities. We've got these quantities. How do we compute those? Well, you take the state and you say, well, we could up the left side, the number of steps you count will be the number you need going up this way plus the number you need going up that way. Those are two independent sources of penalty. So we're going to have two terms, one for going up the left and one for going up the right. And what we have to consider for this one is there's four possibilities. It could change into an A, it could stay a C, it could change into a G, or it could change into a T. For each of those, what do you want to do? You want to say, well, if it's going to change into an A, we're going to count the penalty for changing from a C to an A plus whatever is there, whatever the number of steps are needed further up the tree if you're at an A. For not changing, we count the penalty for changing from C to C. Usually that's zero, but actually a Tegnell's algorithm does allow you to penalize for staying in the same state. It's possible in his algorithm. It's the cost of going from C to C plus whatever number is there. The cost of going to G plus whatever number is there, the cost of going to G plus whatever number is there. And that's what this is. It says we take those four possible numbers and we pick the smallest of them. So it's the minimum over all the states you could go to, J, of the cost of going there plus whatever was already there. So bookkeeping. And you do that on the left node, the left. Consider from the starting point, which is just the C1, you consider all four possibilities, you pick the smallest of those numbers, then you consider all four possibilities on the right and pick the smallest of those numbers, and that's what these two formulas are telling you to do. So it's very simple. It does require you to compute these four numbers here. You're going to do 16 of these counts of the penalty plus what's there, because you're going to do, for each of these four quantities, you're going to do four things up the left and four things up the right. So actually, it's a total of 32 operations. By the way, if you had more than two descendants, the result immediately generalizes by just adding additional terms. There's nothing complicated happens. You just have to consider all of those descendants, and you do the analogous thing. So you can work out the four numbers here with a modest number of operations. And then you're going to go down the tree propagating those from node to node until you get to the bottom. And when you get to the bottom, what have you got? For this site, remember this is all for one site, you're going to, I think I do want some light because I'm going to sleep. Okay. when you get to the bottom, you're going to have four numbers. And what are they? They are the total number of the minimum number of changes, of the minimum penalty. Given that that's an A, given that that's a C, given that that's a G, and given that that's a T. What do you want to do? You just want to take the smallest of those four. So it's the min of those four quantities that you have at the bottom. So, okay, this is the abstract discussion. Now let me show it to you working.
By bottom you mean like at
the root. Well, this is part of a tree.
Right.
A big complicated tree, lots of, and then there's the node down at the bottom. Uh-huh. The bottom fork, the bottommost fork in the tree. Okay, let's show this working. Okay, this is the same thing I showed you before, the same tree with CACAG, but now what we're going to do, we're going to have an arbitrary cost matrix, and we're going to say, well, we've, in the Fitch algorithm, we were penalizing you one for any change of state, but I want to penalize more for a transversion than for a transition. Suppose somebody said, I'd like a parsimony that penalizes you more for considering a change from purine to pyrimidine or from pyrimidine to purine than it would within those categories. Okay, so here's the cost table. It's zero down the diagonal, no cost for staying in the same state. If you go from A to G or from G to A, A to G or G to A, you get one unit of cost. From C to T or T to C, one, and for all the others, 2.5. Why 2.5? I just picked it out of thin air. I want to penalize more. Maybe let's try penalizing 2.5 times as much for a transversion as for a transition. Okay. Then what's the count for this tree? Well, you can see immediately it's not going to be obvious. You can't just glance at it and do the result by eyeball, which is what we did before. But we can use the Sankoff algorithm. And when you do that, you get these numbers. Let me try to rationalize a couple of them. I won't do all of them. Let's take this one. You're at an A here. The possibilities, that this number, what will it be? Well, it'll be the cost of going to an A plus what's there, which is zero. Or the cost of going to a C plus what's there, which is infinity, so that's going to be infinite. You're not going to consider that. So it'll just be zero plus zero up this way. But over on this side, you can't stay the same. It'll be 2.5 plus zero, plus, sorry. It'll be one, because A is a purine and G is a purine. It'll be one plus zero. So the cost here will be 0 plus 1, and there it is. Likewise, if you start here, you're going to have to, this is a C, which is a pyrimidine, you're going to have to do a 2.5 change up here and another 2.5 change up there, and you're going to get 5. And I claim that just considering that, you'll get 1515 as the four numbers there. Over on this side, and A, well, it can't stay the same. It's going to have to get a 2.5 change this way, but it can stay the same on that side and get zero. The smallest possible number here is 2.5. Similarly, for C, it's 2.5, and for G and T, it's 3.5. Because if you're in a G, for example, you have to make a 2.5 change up the left side, plus a change of 1, because it's changed from an A to a G to an A. This side, 2.5 plus 1 is 3.5. So working your way through the algorithm, there it's easy because there's a lot of infinities. You can just throw away those possibilities. You get 2.5, 2.5, 3.5, 3.5. Okay. Now we continue on down. This is going to be 3.5, 3.5, 3.5, 4.5. And then here, from these two, you can work from those, and I can work out any particular one that people. Let's consider this one here. It's an A now. It will be 0 change plus 3.5, or 2.5 plus 3.5, that's too high, or 1 plus 2.5, that's 3.5. Or 2.5 plus 4.5, that's too high. So the total contribution here is going to be 3.5. Let's see, and it will come from this one here. Zero plus 3.5, something higher. Okay, over on this side, starting from this one, it'll be 0 plus 2.5, and the others will all be higher than that. So the result will be 2.5 plus 3.5 is 6 down here. So this number 6 is gotten by that algorithm that I showed you. And you, yeah, please.
So you were just describing the dynamic programming.
This is a dynamic programming algorithm. Yeah. It solves partial problems. For example, when you get down to here, you've solved the problem of how many changes are needed in this whole chunk of the tree, given the unknown states here, and you get different numbers for them. And you keep propagating that down, and that is very analogous to the problem of if I want to go from Seattle to Pullman, Washington, if we could work out the driving time to North Bend from here, and if we happen to know the solution from North Bend, that would tell us of all routes through North Bend. It's working the same way.
I guess I was wondering, is it called Senecoff because you're adding this extra cost matrix that he developed, or?
It's called Senecoff because it was invented by Senecoff. It's the Senecoff algorithm because it can make use of the cost algorithm. That's the first thing. They're actually, if you work out the algorithm, a rationale like this for the Fitch algorithm, they'll turn out to differ. This is not something that I should go into more, but that if you do a Sankoff type algorithm at the bottom end of a branch, considering only changes up that branch, you get the Fitch algorithm. Fitch algorithm is not actually a special case of the Sankoff algorithm, but it's very closely related. And the one of them gets you bookkeeping up at the top of a branch and the other at the bottom of a branch. They both work. So they're close cousins. But this one is the full Sankoff algorithm with this table. Okay, so we get to the bottom and we find 6, 6, 7, 8. The cost, the best cost is these two numbers, either of them. And the penalty for that tree is 6 for this particular site. So once again, we have an algorithm that can be implemented by computer without any difficulty, can take care of it, it can take into account an arbitrary cost matrix. I haven't thought of the issue of what would happen if you had negative costs, but I think it could probably even handle that. I'm not sure there's a biological meaning to that, but it can handle cases where staying with the same state gets penalized. That'll work. So that's the Fitch algorithm and the Sankoff algorithm, and so you can have a computer, you can make a computer do this. The interesting thing is, it does not necessarily result in choosing what state is here. It gives you costs given all four possibilities. If you want to reconstruct the states, I think I've got this here. Oh yeah. Let me just look ahead. Okay. Yeah. If you want to reconstruct the states, I'll talk about it at a later lecture. There is a way of going back up through these tables and finding routes that are the scenarios that achieve this minimum of 6. Just as there are for the driving problem, if you know it takes 21 minutes to that bottom city, you can then work your way back up through the graph and pick and find the actual route. Now, when you do this, it leads to what will be, as we come to consider different trees, it leads to a big economy. The Sankoff algorithm that we just had, it creates, at each site, it creates sets. It creates a little array of numbers at each interior node of the tree. And you propagate those down through the tree. So if I have this tree here, and let's say I put the root, maybe here, I can work my way down, leaving behind all those little arrays. And I can do that at every site. And if you have a computer, there's room to store them, so you can store them all. Now suppose I get to the bottom, and I come up with a score, it takes 695.3 changes of state. You can have fractional changes of state, as you've seen, for that tree. And suppose somebody comes along and says, look, I want you to consider a tree that's it's almost the same as this, but a little different. I want to rearrange down here in the tree. I want to take M and N, and instead of hooking M over here and N over there, I want to hook them to each other. And I want to get the smallest number of steps. Well, the interesting thing, the economy that people saw quite early, is to say, well, to compute the number of changes for this tree is not as hard, because you don't have to spend any time going through and reworking out all these states here, or all the arrays there, or all the arrays there. They're already there. You've got them sitting there. So let's just use them. Take the array at the very bottom of each of these subtrees and work from there. And when you do that, very quickly, you get the effect of changing the tree. So if you leave behind all those arrays, it also gives you a method for taking a region of the tree, modifying it, and quickly getting the score without going back and redoing all the computations, because they'll all essentially be the same.
So, but we're headed for the issue now of considering other trees. And where we start next time, we're going to spend next lecture on combinatorics and on the issue of how many trees are there out there anyway. And I'm going to compute some mind-boggling numbers. It's in a way gamesmanship and fun and games, and it's not serious biology, but at least it tells you there are enough different trees that you don't want to, unless you absolutely have to, consider the possibility of looking at every possible tree. You'll want to have some methods that go faster than that. So that's where we pick up next time, is counting the number of trees.